Arabia until the
I wouldn't call it secondary to them. I think that'll complicate the problems
kick
even
them out.
More.
Anyway, in fact,
history.
In fact, the British would have colonized the moon, but there were no people there for them to oppress.
Well, Newt Gingrich still wants to do that.
Oh, Garland, that's right.
So there are people who still want to colonize the moon. I want to talk about the Middle East tonight, specifically, though not exclusively, about Syria, about Egypt, and about Iran. If you read today's newspaper, The Washington Post, you see that the conflict in Syria has already spilled across the borders into Turkey and Lebanon. The dictator of Syria, Bashar al-Assad.
A chip off the old block.
He is a chip off the old block.
You talk about a chip off the old block.
I was actually going to discuss that because he's killed about 10,000 people, 10,000 innocent civilians. His father has him still beat because in 1982, his father took the fourth largest city in Syria, a city called Hama, and basically wiped it off the map.
He raised the city,
He did. He killed between 20 and 40,000 people, possibly more. We do not know the numbers. And literally took bulldozers and raised the city to the ground so this ancient city would be no more, thinking that would prevent the people from rising.
Do we know how many people were killed by the colonizers before all of that?
I'm sure quite a number.
I'm sure that number would get up there too, by England
the
and
way
France.
It worked,
and
well, actually, before them was Turkey, the Ottoman Empire.
And well, the Ottoman Empire, that was not necessarily a friendly empire either.
No, and prior to that, you had the Crusaders, and the Byzantine Kingdom, and prior to that, you had the Romans.
And the damned human race
there. Oh, and Muhammad definitely colonized a large area in the 7th century.
Mark, it sounds like people are just pretty screwed up, aren't they?
It's been a tough region because it is where Europe, Asia, and Africa come together.
Let me just throw this out there. Ask the Native Americans. This ain't been the greatest region either.
At least the Native Americans basically lived undisturbed, basically fighting with each other until we came and wiped them all out. That's right. At least they have a history of constantly being conquered. Persia, Iran did its share of conquering for a period of time.
Yeah, they lived in peace until, civilized world found them.
Oh, no, that's a little simplistic, my historical friend.
No, they did not live in peace until they were constantly fighting each other. You can go read the Bible.
I mean, they had skirmishes, but they didn't wipe out 75% of the entire population of North America.
You're right. I grant you that genocide that white Americans committed to Native Americans really stands alone as one of the most successful.
No, you're speaking of the colonial era? Or
I'm talking about 1700s America.
Andrew Jackson.
Those guys.
What we did with smallpox actually rivals any genocide and maybe the most successful one in human history. But we're not talking about that tonight.
But you can't call smallpox genocide. I mean, that's a little
foolish. Well, we purposely gave blankets filled with
smallpox. Although there were cases, with the Puritans, in fact, were giving blankets that smallpox volumes had died in, and then they were passing them on. It's another story.
But
we're not on that topic.
Unfortunately, the Native Americans. Well, we need to have a show, frankly, on Native Americans.
Yes, we should. But we should get Nightwolf to join us.
But that is, we should actually. We should invite him.
Yeah,
that's a good idea.
I don't think we can contain Nightwolf on a show like.
No. You know what? We don't need to.
You can't stop him. You can only help to contain him.
That's
kind of like Michael Jordan.
But let's talk about the Middle East, because what's going on in Syria?
It's tragic.
It is, and I argued, you may remember, with the two of you, it seems like ages ago, but I think it was less than a year ago, that in Libya, when Muammar Gaddafi said that he was going to go into everybody's closets, they can't hide from him, and massacre the people of Benghazi, I said we need to help the Libyan people free themselves.
Well, I was kind of with you, Mark.
I actually think President Obama did a good job. But, Terry, I remember you arguing at that time that we only help people when there's oil under the soil. And of course, Libya had oil under the soil, and I said just because it has oil doesn't mean we shouldn't help them. Yeah. And so I will be consistent, even if our president isn't, and say we need to help the people of Syria in the same vein. Now, I should just say there are lots of complications
here. Oh, are there?
In Egypt, for example, we had a dictator that we supported for several decades. And now you have in Egypt, you have a presidential election between a guy who represents the military, the old Mubarak forces.
I wonder who's going to win that one.
No. And you have the Islamic Brotherhood. It's likely to win. But people who support the circumcision of women do not support rights for Christians and will probably run it like the Iranian theocracy.
Which I don't think is going
to
happen.
Which brings me to the Iranian theocracy, which is busy building a nuclear weapon underneath a mountain.
That's not verified at all. Let's not spread rumors.
So I want to deal with all these subjects
tonight.
Let's start with Syria, but as these conflicts tend to spill across borders, I have no doubt we'll touch on Egypt and Iran as well. And if you want to throw in Libya, Tunisia, or anyone else in the area.
Well, you mentioned Eritrea. We never talk about Eritrea.
We promised we would do that.
Eritrea?
I
don't really know what's going on in Eritrea, but I'm sure it's something.
We told our listener, Tesla.
Yes, that we that will.
Well, I wonder if we should do that at a time when he can call in.
Yeah.
We should wait for when we're in studio to talk about Eritrea,
the Congo and Ethiopia.
Tesla will give us a full context.
We're going to have to research too.
Speaking of research, I know you've been reading the same article. But the complexity, which we probably ought to introduce here, and this is from again the Washington Post, and it's just 9 points that need. There are no easy answers in this situation.
Just nine.
Just nine that in this two paragraphs. Number one, Turkey, of course, is a NATO member,
yes,
which makes it, you know, really kind of tricky.
And was just shot at by Syrian forces.
And
just,
they have a 550-mile border with Syria.
Right.
And number two, Assad has supporters, guess where, in Turkey and in Lebanon.
Yeah, the Alawite. Members of the Alawite minority.
And also Hezbollah is basically a supporter of Assad.
Yes, and they're in Gaza and
so
in Lebanon.
The Shiite militia. And they've been allied with him for quite a while. And the Shiite-linked Alawite sect is also involved, although Hezbollah's chief political rival, former Lebanese prime minister, Saad Hariri, I probably mispronounced that, has called for Assad to step down. Number five, Iraq dominates Shiite fear that an Islamist Sunni government in Syria would build alliances with Iraq's disgruntled Sunnis. Meanwhile, of course, there's Iran, whose Shiite leaders are Assad's staunchest allies.
They're the ones who are arming Assad, basically giving him the weapons he's using to kill the people.
Number seven, of course, Turkey and Iran have been, you know, okay with each other, but now they're sort of divided because nobody knows what to do with Assyria. Number eight, Turkey has resisted allowing its territory to be used in intervening in Syria without international legal authority, which there isn't.
But that may change now that they've been shot into.
Yeah, and now there's Saudi Arabia and three other Persian Gulf countries that are agreeing to give financial support to the rebels. But all of this is...
You left out Russia.
Well, there's Russia and China.
Who have ties to Syria. Yeah,
that have ties to Syria. So, Garland...
Well, it's complex.
It is a little bit complex.
Just a smidgen.
We hope to take it apart as much as we can. One thing Terry didn't mention too much of is the occupied country of Lebanon, which is occupied by Syrian forces, which tried to free itself when Syria killed its duly elected leader and got invaded. It's a mess. It's a mess. Let me ask you, Garland, I guess, the easy question, and then take it to the hard question.
There's an easy question?
Yeah, there is an easy question.
Right.
The easy question.
What time is it? That's the only one.
Yeah, right.
Would it be inconsistent to say that because we help the Libyan rebels, we help the Libyan people achieve some measure of autonomy, overthrow their dictator, that even though Syria doesn't have oil, we should do the same with the Syrian people? That's the easy question. The complicated question is, do all the millions of factors that Terry and I raise make it so that there is some exception to this rule, or is it all about oil?
Good question. You got two things going on here. A, you have geopolitical factors, and B, you have people who are being massacred. Generally, I'm one who tends to side with people who are being massacred.
I would think so.
And fix the and deal with the geopolitical factors lately. You know, if you were huddled in a small closet somewhere in a Syrian city, and there were rocket propelled grenades and artillery raining down on you, you probably wouldn't really be thinking a lot about how Iran and Shiite government was dealing with Hezbollah, and how the Chinese wanted to address the issue. So I think that the proper way to look at this is from a human perspective, of the perspective of saving human lives. And then, what's going to happen geopolitically is going to happen. In fact, if you don't do the quote right thing here, I don't think anything's going to turn out better. If you don't save people, because people are going to be angry.
This is going to shock you, but I think Obama is doing a very good job with this. I really do. Because it is so incredibly complex. And the key seemed to be for a while that having the Turkish prime minister, and I forget his name.
Erdogan.
Yeah, him being the prime minister and sort of being the liaison between the United Nations and the United States.
But he's turned against Assad. Assad just shot into his country.
Yeah, and Syria. I mean, that was a really good possibility there as a mediator. But now that's been destroyed. And the difference between Libya and Syria, and I hate to say this, but frankly, in the Middle East, nobody gave a damn about Libya. I mean, they really did.
They were already isolated.
Except for the oil, but that's no big deal.
But it was already pretty isolated.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, Gaddafi
pretty,
basically made everybody
angry. Yeah, and nobody gave a damn about Gaddafi. I mean, so they weren't going to intervene. This is so complex that I really do think what Obama is doing, what President Obama is doing in this situation and some other leaders, is the right thing to do. They are moving slow, which is tragic, and I agree with Garland in my heart, but the geopolitical thing is so big and so complex that if we could just get China and Russia behind the UN resolution, mm-hmm. then we can really begin to do things. We've got the Arab League now supplying some money or some financing for the rebels.
Yes.
I think these are the routes, as tragic as they are. Waiting, this delay is horrible, but I think those are the routes we have to go.
Let me say this. Erdogan, the Turkish government said just in today's newspaper that there's a new stage because Syrian troops, of course, have fired mm-hmm. into the NATO ally, into Turkey. So he said there's a new stage. I don't think he's any huge fan of Assad. I would argue, actually, that there are really only Iran and Russia who really support this dictator. China, I think, does almost for its own reasons. It doesn't want its own people.
Russia's backing off. Russia's kind of backing off.
Russia is now, even Russia and China supported Conan. Why am I blanking? Conan.
What are we talking about? Gaddafi?
No.
The United Nations.
Ex-UN Security General.
Yeah, the UN Security.
Kofi Annan. I said Conan. No wonder I messed up. Yeah. Kofi Annan, they supported his plan, which was basically the Syrian government had 2 weeks to remove all their troops from the main cities. And I have to say, I was not surprised when on day 14, the end of the 2 weeks, Assad said, "Screw you, world. I'm going to continue to kill people."
Because that's what he does.
That's what he does. That's what his father does. That's how they stay in power. I think the Syrian government is really, again, it's beholden to people who aren't particularly our friends, Vladimir Putin of Russia and the dictators of Iran. As far as I'm concerned.
But you've got to understand, Iran's caught too, but with China. I mean, that tie in there.
But China ain't going to go to war to save Syria. I think that's pretty safe to say.
I'm sorry, what?
China's not going to go to war.
No, but China.
To save Assad.
But China, unfortunately, is getting most of Iran's oil.
Well, that's
so
true.
There's that.
We're going to get to Iran in a minute.
Let
me just deal with Syria for a second here. In my view, and again, I do not support invasion. I did not support the invasion of Iraq. I did not support the invasion of Libya. But what we did in Libya with air support and people on the ground who were fighting their own battles for their own country seems to me pretty much the way to go. I don't think Syria has a lot of friends. They have a few more friends than Gaddafi. But Russia's not going to go to war for Syria. China's not going to go to war for Syria. And Iran's not going to go to war for Syria. So basically, even the Syrian army is not going to go to war for Syria. You may know that Assad is part of a minority, the Alawite sect, which is basically a Shiite sect in a Sunni land. They have no more than 10% of the population. When Assad wants to crack down and kill a bunch of people who are, you know, uprising and marching for free speech and things like that, he actually takes his, you might call him his SS, his little group, 30,000 strong, not too little, but he takes the part of his army that's Alawite.
Yep.
And he uses them to do the really hard massacres because he can't trust the rest of his army to do it because they'd be killing their own people.
Yeah.
It seems to me that it's not working through the UN Security Council. And I guess I take issue, Terry, I'll get you to respond, then I'll get to Garland, with the idea that we need Russia and China's permission to do the right thing. They gave us permission in Libya. Is that really the linchpin that we need their permission?
It's not that that's the linchpin. It's that I do think if anything too overt happens, you know, without the UN and without the international community really behind it, the Middle East in general will simply explode. I mean, we've left out Israel, of course, which is involved in this in a sense. I mean, it's not so much
in Syria, more in Iran, no question.
Yeah, but also, it's part of its border.
Yeah,
you know,
border
Syria. And there's Lebanon.
I'm not so sure the Israelis want us to intervene because they have a certain stability with an evil dictator and they don't know what's going to happen with the Syrian people.
Yeah.
But as far as I'm concerned, I want to do a Libya-style action in Syria. What do you think, Robert?
Well, I think that's the eventuality for this reason. Assad, you know, has crossed the tipping point. You know, these quote evil dictators, when they get to a certain, you know, once you've gotten to a certain point, there's no turning back, and he's past that point. So there's not going to be anyone who feels that maybe there can be some kind of a deal struck, we can work something out. He has now been involved in horrific you know, horrific crimes against humanity.
Thousands
so
and thousands.
The only place for him is in an international court. So he can, the only way that he can leave Syria now, that he can leave power, honestly, is either to surrender himself to the international court, which he ain't doing, or feet first. So I think we're at a point where, however we get to our final acts, it's going to have to be the international community is going to have to either move to get him out or turn their back and allow him to do whatever he's going to do, because I don't think there's any in between. There is no bargaining.
And let me point out that he's also done something that even Gaddafi didn't do. He's murdered journalists. Gaddafi, at least, I mean, he had minders and they restricted journalists and so forth into certain areas. But Syria basically says, we don't want any journalists in here because you're going to record our massacres. So we're just going to kill you, including Western journalists, murdered dead by Assad's army. I want to push back. I wanted to give you a chance, Terry, on the Russia-China thing, because in Bosnia, of course, in Kosovo, the United States acted without Russian support. We acted with NATO support, and I agree with you, we need NATO support. This isn't something the United States should do alone. But if we can get England and France and Western countries, and let's face it, most of the Arab world doesn't like Assad. Saudi Arabia would certainly support us.
Yep.
Turkey, I think, would be very supportive of us. If we got that kind of international coalition that did not include Russia and China, and let the people themselves fight the battles, but maybe arm them and maybe some air support, could I get you on board?
We don't need Russia and China to join in anyway. We need them to simply step aside.
Yeah,
but let's say they're not.
But the key thing is, I mean, you bring up the example of Bosnia. It's a different world than it was then.
Agree.
Truly. And, you know, if you remember during that conflict, we actually bombed, supposedly by mistake, I seriously doubt it, the Chinese embassy.
I think it was by
mistake. And China said, oh, that's too bad. We're sorry you did that. It's a different world now. China controls our debt, right?
But
right.
What is China going to do realistically in Syria? I don't think anything. I don't think
it's not that they're going to do something overt. It's that everything is now so interconnected. China is desperate for energy and for oil, which means, you know, if you, for instance, if we attacked, say, Syria, and Iran doesn't like it, and they try to block the Straits of Hormuz, thank you.
We can stop them.
You know, stop. No, so now it's escalated to that. So now China's got its oil supply interrupted. Yeah. Now China's going to get very angry. Russia, of course, is also shipping oil out of there like crazy. You've got what's going to happen in this case, which would not happen in Libya, is you will have every single nation in the Middle East. And besides every single nation you usually think of, all of these, I can't remember the names of half of them, but Kazakhstan, whatever those countries are right up on the tip.
Right. Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan.
Yeah, all of those who also are involved heavily in oil and gas, they're going to be involved. You're going to have that whole region involved. They're not going to sit there and say, oh, this is fine.
I think they
You can't leave out Shiite and Sunni influence. You cannot leave that out of the equation.
But if you look here, you have a Shiite minority controlling a Sunni country.
Mm-hmm.
There are only really two Shiite majority governments in the region. One is Iraq, which Maliki owes his place in power to us. I don't think he's going to go and attack U.S. troops. I just don't think that's going to happen. You do have Iran, but Iran's got its own world surrounding it with its nuclear power. I just don't see them going in there and attacking Syrian people. They'll ship arms to Assad.
May not even be attacked. Just think of that Shiite link there. If Iraq, Iran, and Syria all come together through their Shiite ties.
I don't think
you've got a block there that has enormous power.
Let me go and throw another country in the mix here.
All right.
Because Egypt has had some very interesting things. Now, many of you know that I try to be consistent. I opposed the Mubarak government. I supported the people there, too. Now, that was an interesting one because the Mubarak government was our friend, unlike Gaddafi or Assad.
Friend is an interesting word.
He was pro-American.
He
was a vicious dictator. He tortured and murdered his own people.
Yeah.
But he, unlike Gaddafi and Assad, served American interests. He was, in the famous words of Franklin Delano Roosevelt when talking about Somoza, the dictator of Nicaragua, he was an SOB, but he was our SOB.
Which mark?
The American.
What's interesting is, you know what's interesting, I mean, morally, ethically, with what you just said? He murdered his own people, he did all these horrible things, but he served American interests.
That's right.
Isn't it
you know, odd that America can support people. You know, basically, he was Assad light. Okay.
Yeah, he was Assad light.
And we weren't,
I'll accept
we
that.
Were fine. In fact, not only were we fine with him, we
right.
were giving him billions of dollars
right.
because he was doing things our way.
That's
it
right.
almost makes you think that if Assad was doing what we wanted,
right.
then we might
maybe
just
so.
Say,
but Assad's
but,
not.
But
here's my point about Egypt, okay? So I've at least been consistent in being against Mubarak, against Gaddafi, and against Assad. When the people rise, again, I don't think we should invade these countries, but I think we should help them get their own democracy. But Egypt is a difficult circumstance because now we have the two main candidates in the Egyptian presidency, and we have reached the fear of the both. We really like the third candidate, the ones who represent the liberal Democrats who are standing in Tahrir and want freedom for everybody, including
you mean the majority?
the small minority that actually believes in democracy.
I think it's a majority.
Well, the majority is now between the Muslim Brotherhood and the candidate of the military. And so you've got basically Mubarak light on one hand, and then you have, on the other hand, Iran light, people who do not support rights for women, do not support rights for minorities like Christians, support things like female circumcision and some really, really brutal stuff. And so to me, I look at Egypt and I say, well, I'm glad the people are free of Mubarak, but we do have reason to fear the future in Egypt. I think we should leave it alone and let the people decide what they may, but at the same time, I would put verbal pressure, and only verbal pressure, on them to have a true democracy that lets everyone, including women, including Christians, including minorities, have a voice, and it shouldn't be a theocracy. It should be something that's based on some kind of democracy.
Well, you know I'm a fanatic idealist in most areas.
Get out of here.
Yeah, surprise. I
thought just fanatic.
Well, that too. But, you know, I mean, we're talking here, you know, some very idealistic terms, and life just ain't that simple, and I wish it really were.
Oh, it's going to be ugly in Egypt no matter what happens.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Egypt, I mean, Mubarak, again, he was a puppet to the military for all practical purposes. It's the military that was powerful
yep.
in Egypt. It's the military that's powerful today in Egypt.
Yep.
It's the military that's going to be powerful
yep.
in tomorrow.
Agree,
in Egypt.
I agree.
Either that or the Muslim Brotherhood. Either one.
But it's going to be the military. The military is not going to give up. They're not going to give up.
No.
They're not going to step aside. The Muslim Brotherhood may have some input or not, but that's not really even important.
No.
Because what you're always talking about, and this is so ugly about the world, but it's reality too, and this is again why I do think Obama is taking a very good approach to it as realistic as possible, is you're talking about power and you're talking about influence and you're talking about resources. There's only one reason that we really want to support Egypt, besides somewhat, you know, not having any more conflict with Israel, which is part of it. But the main reason is the friggin' Suez Canal. That's what it comes down to.
It's also
and
the largest Arab country in the world. It's
yeah.
centrally located.
But
it's,
you want that Suez Canal
yes.
open so you can move goods
sure.
through.
Yeah.
It's crucial.
That's true.
Yes.
It's absolutely crucial. And that's the goal. You know, the Egypt, you know, I wish for once the world really would say, hey, these people are hurting. We can't let them hurt like that. But that's not the way
and
the
that's
world
what's,
works.
And that's what the support of Mubarak was all about. It was about the Suez Canal. It was,
yeah.
it was about big corporations being able to move their goods and Western people in the West being able to live in fine houses and live a wonderful life, regardless of what happened to the people in Egypt. I personally do think, let's face it, Mark, when it comes down to figuring out who's going to win, most of the time the guy with the guns wins.
Yeah.
The military is going to win.
They may, in which case I hope we take a principled stand against them. But to me, I look at history. And I look at, you can go back to the French Revolution or the Russian Revolution. And sometimes, you know, the Tsar and the king are bad, but the revolutionaries are bad in their own way. And then they take power
yep.
and they kill their own people.
Yeah.
I can think back to the Cold War in the 70s when you had all these brutal dictatorships supported by the United States, right-wing dictatorships that were doing massacres and awful things. And they were being opposed by communist parties with links to Russia. And they wanted to do awful things. And I kept saying, isn't there a third way? And that's how I feel about Egypt. You know, I pox on the Muslim Brotherhood, a pox on the military. I want those students in Tahrir Square.
Well, you know, but not whether it's.
Wait. We gotta take a break.
Oh.
We gotta take a break. When we come
back, we haven't
back,
solved the problem.
Not yet. But in the second half, we will solve the problem of Syria and Egypt, and we're gonna bring in Iran. We're here at Ben's Next Door. Come join us, 1211 U Street. You can talk to right back after this.
Jazz up your spring and celebrate Black classical music with concerts, poetry, exhibits, family activities, and more citywide throughout the month of April. WPFW is proud to be the media sponsor in the nation's capital for Jazz Appreciation Month. Go to smithsonianjazz.org for a full calendar of events. WPFW, your station for jazz and justice, serving the collective need and imagination of the community.
Into the night and back to the Raucous Caucus.
Welcome back to the Raucous Caucus. I am Mark Levine, sitting here with
Bashar Assad.
No,
Garland Nixon.
No, Garland Nixon. No, we're going to execute you and turn you over war crimes. Garland Nixon and
Terry D. Kester.
And we are the Raucous Caucus. And we are here at Ben Next Door, next door to Ben's Chili Bowl. There's still time for you to join us. 1211 U Street. We have people up here who are listening to us right now.
And we have audience giving us trouble already. Hi, Bill.
We're here every Tuesday at 7 p.m. And in the month of April, every Tuesday at Ben's Next Door. It's easy to find. It's next door to Ben's Chili Bowl. You walk in the back, you climb up the stairs, and it's behind the curtain.
You will find
the magic.
Why is our engineer crawling on the floor?
You're not supposed to tell him what's going on behind the curtain.
See, it was part of the drama.
If you came and joined us at Ben's Next Door, you would see such
Daniel.
Drama.
Oh, the shenanigans.
As Daniel.
Betwixt the technical equipment.
Behind the curtain. So, before the break, we talked about commentary from the audience. See, by the way, Bill, if you want to comment, there's a microphone right here. You can make it official because they can't hear you when you shout from the audience. All right. We talked about Syria and Egypt. As Terry said before the break, we haven't quite solved those problems yet.
Right. But we're close.
We're going to. We still have 30 minutes.
Yeah, you're right.
All right. I do want to throw in one more problem into the mix, and that, of course, is the country of Iran. Now, according to the International Atomic Energy Agency, the same agency, by the way, that said very clearly to George W. Bush that Iraq did not have weapons of mass destruction and you're making a mess out of nothing, says quite clearly that Iran is pursuing a nuclear weapon.
Have they really said they could?
You can disagree with me. Let me give my points. They will not allow the IAEA to investigate their underground facilities. They have at least, they think they have about six, but the two main ones are Natanz and I think it's called Oz? What is it? It's underneath the mountain. Anyway, even though under their treaty obligations they're required to, and so the entire world, to its credit, not just the United States, but Europe as well, is putting some pretty massive sanctions on Iran, even sanctioning the central bank. Even though Europe uses its oil, they're turning down its oil, and apparently it's having some hardship on the Iranian economy. I'm actually okay with what Obama's doing with sanctions now. I do fault him, though, for 2 years ago during what was called the Green Revolution. It's the revolution that preceded the Arab Spring a year earlier when the people of Iran rose up to overthrow their government. I'm not saying we should have invaded, but at the same time, I think we could have given more moral support at least to people trying to overthrow the dictatorship when they fixed an election then. If you've seen one thing, I've tried to be consistent. I always try to be on the side of people in the streets who want freedom against a dictator. In any case, there's some very tough questions with Iran. Iran has threatened Israel very strongly, and Israel, if it does, have a window of opportunity of a few months, perhaps, to take out Iran's nuclear weapon. That may well happen. If they don't, we can. Some say let Israel do it. Some say we should do it. Some say let Iran get a nuclear weapon. And Terry, I think you say they're not trying, but I don't buy that.
I don't think Iran is that big of a threat. I honestly don't. Because Iran has a history, a long history of not being aggressive, as a matter of fact. Do I trust them? I'm not saying I trust them. I'm not saying that. But I don't think
there was an Iran-Iraq war that killed thousands.
They were attacked by Iraq. Iran hasn't invaded anybody in like 1,300 years.
Yeah, right. There is no conceivable advantage that Iran will gain if it were to do something with a nuclear weapon or even have a nuclear weapon lying around. There's none. And you know, what drives the world is power, unfortunately. And the Ayatollah and, you know, the people in Iran that are in leadership now are not going to blow that, no matter what, because they want their power.
Yep.
The other thing that I believe in very strongly, and I'm reading a book right now, which I highly recommend because it'll terrify you. It's called Flyboys. And it's by James, I was going to say Brady, but it doesn't sound quite right.
Anyway, Brown.
No, and it's about World War II, but it's about the atrocities the Americans committed, and it's about the atrocities the Japanese committed. And it is unbelievable. It is far more than you've ever heard or read about before. And the point is, I do not believe in unleashing the dogs of war. Once you open that gate, once you unleash those dogs, you are subjecting millions of people to atrocity and terror that you cannot imagine. And it'll happen more in the Mideast probably than any other point. So everything that we can possibly do to contain the situation, to deal with the situation, to influence the situation has to be done and continually done. And never forget, one other thing, you know, mutual assured destruction works. It's the only peace policy in the whole history of the world that's worked.
So do you just support the sanctions?
Sanctions, absolutely.
Okay, all right.
Absolutely.
Go ahead.
Okay. My position is this, a couple things. Number one, when I look at Iran and I say, let's just say for the sake of argument, we don't, you know, there's a lot of speculation as to whether they are. Some people say they are. Some people say they aren't. They say they aren't getting nuclear weapons, whatever the case may be. My opinion is this. That I'm with Terry, I don't see Iran as a big threat. Worst case scenario, if they did get a nuclear weapon. If they did get a nuclear weapon. Okay, worst case scenario, right? I don't think it's that big a deal. One thing I noticed about the Iranian leaders, they're old. And they probably want to stay alive. No, but he's not a real leader. Right. So I do not for one second believe, I personally believe that it's propaganda. That propaganda is the propaganda argument is the Iranian leaders are crazy, and as soon as they get the first nuclear weapon, they're going to hurl it at, you know, Israel, whoever, they're going to hurl it at someone and guarantee that their country will be flat, black, and shiny. I don't believe that. I think that is an absolute absurdity. Number one. Number two, the other thing is this. The position that, oh, Israel or the U.S., we are going to go take out what? It's been determined that we cannot stop if they want nuclear, that we cannot, using military airstrikes, take out their nuclear facilities anyway.
Well, sure we can
barely slow them up.
They're buried for 3 to 5 years. Mountains.
But then again, there's another issue, and that is unintended consequences. Now they fire some missiles at the Saudi oil fields. The oil price of oil goes up to $14 a gallon in America, and we're all thrown into a depression. Why? Because we speculated that they may get a nuclear weapon. Israel has 300. We have 10,000. And then we speculated that if they got one, they'd immediately commit suicide. I think it's absurd.
Let me throw more things out there, and then I want to get to Bill, who I know is dying to ask his question. A few things. First of all, you said that Iran hadn't invaded a country in 1,300 years. Well, they basically took over Lebanon. I mean, Hezbollah is financed by Iran.
I thought you said Syria took over Lebanon.
Well, Syria and Iran are almost one entity.
So this is administratively.
Iran funds them both. No, it's not just administratively. It's also with troops because they use Syrian troops and they use Iranian arms.
They didn't use Iranian troops.
They haven't attacked anyone. But they're very close with terrorist groups. And I can tell you this about Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia absolutely does not want Iran to have a nuclear weapon. And they and Egypt are determined themselves to get nuclear weapons if Iran does. If they get it, Kuwait's going to want its own nuclear weapon. And let's face it, so will Libya, so will Pittsburgh. And soon every country in the region will have its own nuclear weapon, some of them with many ties to terrorists. And I don't agree when the gun people say we're safer if everyone's armed. I don't agree that we're in a safer world if every country has a nuclear weapon. I will say this. I do think that if the Iranian weapons are taken out, and I do hope the sanctions work, but as with Iraq's Osirik nuclear plant in 1981, as with the Syrian nuclear plant that Israel took out just a couple years ago, I'm quite confident that particularly because everyone else in the region, the Saudis support Israel on this, and that's not something that happens very often. The Egyptians support Israel on this.
Yeah, but that's a Sunni-Shiite thing.
It's a Sunni-Shiite thing. Yep, none difference. Of the Sunni countries in the region want Iran to have a nuclear weapon. And the other thing I should point out is that the Iranians have admitted, this is not something that they're concealing, that they've already got 20% enrichment. Which apparently is much, much harder to do than the next step, to go from 20% to 90%. So I don't know whether it's months or years. I'm not a nuclear expert, but you can't deny that they're doing it. And the real answer for Iran is we got to convince them to stop the madness, all right? There was a proposal that they could give the stuff to Russia. We would give them civilian nuclear plants. They rejected that proposal, which if they just want it for civilian use, why would they reject it? So I'm suspicious of all of that. I'll get to you both in a minute. I do want to get to Bill right now. Go ahead, Bill.
Okay. First of all, there are aspects of Syria and that I think that's Syria is basically part of the balancing act from my point of view. Now, I want to make you aware that Seymour Hersh was on Democracy Now! This morning, and he was saying that the Iranians essentially have suspended their program to develop the bomb.
Bring in the IAEA
and
prove
I kind
it.
Of think that's
Seymour
true.
Seymour Hersh
but
is pretty thorough.
But I think
they can prove it easy.
That they don't want to appear totally humbled, and I don't blame
nope.
them.
Yeah.
Because if nope. there is, now let me play devil's advocate here, and I don't regard the Iranians as devil. If there's any country in the world today that has a real practical case, if I were their leadership, for wanting nuclear weapons, it's the Iranians.
Who's going to invade Iran?
Nobody's going to invade. But again, just because they want to be in a position where they cannot be readily attacked.
They want to keep funneling.
They don't want
to
become Iraq.
That's right.
And they have an avowed enemy in Israel. They've got India and Pakistan in the other direction again, their own security.
And the Sunni bloc in the neighborhood doesn't like
them
either.
Now, in terms of the United States and the rest of the world, it is practical for us not to want the Iranians to have nukes because there is the possibility that some non-state actors that
Hezbollah,
people like
Hamas.
To call terrorists and various other things, depending on your perspective, might get a hold of something. So let's just throw that into the mix. But I think also that I think I'm going to say something heretical. Personally, I want them to get up to the edge after our elections, and I'll
tell you this, Bill. I think President Obama.
Oh, you like the drama, huh?
I think President Obama definitely feels the same way, and I think when he invited Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu in, I think he said, "Look, I'll make you a deal. Just don't do anything before November." I don't know that that's true.
You know,
but it wouldn't surprise me.
You know, I agree with Bill an awful lot because part of the problem is there is, whether we like it or not, you know, there is such a friggin' arrogance on United States policy around the world. And there has been ever since World War II. Well, it goes back before World War II, trust me. Mm-hmm. Read about Teddy Roosevelt. What a nut job. Anyway.
The Philippines.
He was a great environmentalist, Terry.
He was a crazy imperialist is what he was.
That too.
Yeah. But the United States has this arrogant, heavy-handed attitude that they push on anybody. Iranians are a nation with incredible history, with a great deal of pride, you know, and whether pride is good or bad, you know, they are trying to say, hey, we are an important nation. You said, Bill, that, you know, pointed out that the avowed enemy with Israel, their avowed enemy is the United States and has been for umpteen years, that forced the Shah upon them, you know, then got Iraq and gave Iraq, you know, gas and
Terry, let me
everything
ask you
else to attack, Iranians. The enemy of Iran is the United States of America and has it proved itself as an enemy for decades.
Yeah, but there's another point that we're leaving out here when it comes to Iran. And that is this, to say the position that the Iranians are America's quote enemy. I have some issues with that, first of all. Do you know what country, when you look at the overall population, the people of the country,
I was just gonna
supports
go there.
The United States
the most?
The most
pro-American people in the
are,
Middle East
are the Iranians, the people of Iran.
They're actually the most pro-Israeli
right.
of any people
yeah,
in the Middle East as well.
The people of Iran, 80 million strong, they don't want war. No. They don't want problems. They, you know, want to be able to wear a pair of jeans and mind their own business. Now, what you have is there's this incongruity between the people and the leaders. Right. Therefore, if you go there and bomb the living crap out of the people who like you the most, I don't think that that's going to be positive for us in the long run. So I think we have a delicate balance.
Yes.
And the rest of the world has the Western world has a delicate balance because the potential is there. As I said, let's not forget, the leaders of Iran are all like 80 years old. So there is a potential
but
there.
They're training others. I mean, it's not like you can kill them all in the leadership.
Yeah, the potential is there. For change. The potential is there. And if you look at a 10 or 20 years out, the potential is there to make some moves. But if we just go bomb them, let's face it, they were smart. They built all of their facilities in urban areas. So if you go bomb them, you're going to have to bomb
some cities. Some are beneath the mountain.
Yeah.
Some are beneath mountains.
And some aren't. Yeah. So what are you going to do? I'll bomb the ones beneath the mountains, but I won't bomb the ones in the cities. Well, guess what?
You haven't done anything.
So either you go in there, you bomb, you kill tens of thousands of innocent people, and then you say hooray. You know, and the rest of the people now join with this government that hates you and say, man, you killed my relatives, you killed my friends, let's go get some revenge. I'm with the government now that I hated because I hate these people worse.
You and I are basically in agreement.
One thing I want to say.
I think we should hug, Terry. But Mark's in the way. We can't.
That's why I'm separating the two of you. I remember very clearly about 8 years ago when a guy by the name of Mohammad Khatami was elected president of Iran. Now, he reached out to the West. He reached out to the United States. By Iranian terms, he was definitely a moderate. Even by American terms, he wasn't that radical. And I remember very much advocating for George W. Bush to meet with this man, to work out, to actually even have a
please don't say that name.
Well, I have to tell you, President Bush didn't listen to me. I know that's going to be shocking.
Get out of here.
He did not listen to my advice. He said to this moderate guy, go fly a kite. And, of course, Ahmadinejad and the others are far, far more radical than Khatami was.
And they passed the rule, no kite flying.
And basically what they did is the Iranian people in charge, who's Khamenei, the supreme leader, said, oops, we let the people have an election and they elected a reasonable person. We're never going to do that again. And when Khatami tried to run again, they said, nope, we'll give you a choice between Tweedledum and Tweedledee. And Tweedledum, I think, is Ahmadinejad.
He won.
But that surprised them too, because Tweedledee was their choice. People voted for him. It's just someone else. But I think Garland's point is a good one. It is wrong to conflate a government with the people.
Always.
The Iranian
including
people,
in America, thank you.
Well, that's true. And let's face it, George Bush lost the 2000 election and was our president anyway. But the point is that the people...
So we have a lot in common with Iran.
And that's what
we
do.
The Supreme Court is... What do they call the four guys that run everything?
Five.
The five guys that run everything in Iran? They're going to name...
Supreme Council, Supreme Court.
We have five
to four?
We have five guys in our country that run everything. And they are guys because the three women are liberals.
It do look familiar.
My point is this. I agree completely with Garland that we have to be on the people's side, as such as it can be, supporting people that were involved in the Green Revolution, supporting movements like that. If there is an attack, we gosh darn had better be careful to only go after nuclear weapons and completely avoid
impossible.
Areas.
We'll use like words like surgical strike as
yeah,
a
right. Here
like,
we go.
Like, okay.
It would be very hard to do,
people.
But it has been done in the past.
No, it hasn't.
With Iraq and Syria.
I got to remind you of one other thing too, because
it hasn't been done in the past.
To keep things,
I think it's only the threat of military action that's causing Iran to have the negotiations they're having right now.
To keep things in perspective,
I would argue the opposite.
You've got to remember also, despite all the hysteria, and the hysteria is basically driven by the military-industrial complex. That's who's driving the hysteria at this point. Because now we're out of Iraq. We've got, you know, excess surplus material. We're not even taking out of Iraq. There's no more money being built, although we are building something like, 2,700 F-35s. But anyway, don't forget also that Iran actually helped us after 9/11.
You're correct.
Helped us with intelligence, helped us with security issues, helped us in terms of...
That was a Shiite-Sunni thing again.
Whatever it was, you know, you cannot label any part of Iran in some simplistic terms.
I'm not labeling Iran. I'm labeling the government. The one thing we all three agree on is we have to make distinguishing between the country of Iran and the history of Persia and a very long, proud country that has every right to be, that was never invaded, and the people of Iran with... the government. The one thing I think we all agree on is that we must make a very important distinction between those two groups.
But you've also got to deal with both.
Which means you can't bomb them.
Right.
If the distinction exists, you can't bomb them, Bill. Sorry about
just
that.
Just one very short, important thing that I forgot to drop in the mix before. Part of the reason why, and including what I mentioned about Seymour Hersh was saying this morning, we are probably keeping the heat on Iran to keep as best we can to influence Israel.
Oh, I think so.
To do what they
want. I think
want,
if there weren't sanctions, Israel
Netanyahu probably wants to do.
I actually agree with you, Bill. If there were no sanctions and if the world were not taking action, I suspect Israel would have bombed their nuclear sites months ago.
Yeah. And I'll tell you another reason we're keeping pressure on Iran, because we don't have any control or very little control over Iraq anymore. Despite that horrible war and all that slaughter and all that money, we now have Shiite-run Iraq, and we have Shiite Iran, and we basically are sitting around going, we blew it.
Well, and Maliki, just for those of you who don't know, the prime minister of Iraq, who is a Shiite, a majority Shiite country, just put a warrant out for his deputy, for his vice president, who is a Sunni, a warrant for his arrest. When we designed the Iraqi system, we said, okay, it's a majority Shiite country, it should have a Shiite president, but at least the Sunnis will have some power via this vice president who is now under arrest. So, Terry, I couldn't agree with you more despite thousands of Americans dead, tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of Iraqis dead.
Hundreds of thousands.
An invasion that cost $1 trillion, we end up with a country that is certainly not a U.S. client.
I would disagree with one point Terry made, and that is he spoke of a control as if we're, you know, losing control of Iraq. We never had control over Iraq. The only thing we did was we used propaganda to fool our citizens into thinking that we had control of Iraq.
Well, we had
a tiger by
there.
The tail, and it was swinging us around, and we finally were able to let go and run off before the tiger.
We had enough control to create a power shift, not necessarily a good one, but a power shift. And we thought that was going to work.
We were part of a power shift. Yeah. I don't think we controlled it. We created an environment in which a power shift occurred, and we were bystanders observing the power shift.
Speaking of tiger by the tail, there is another country in the Middle East. There's only one, in fact, that has large numbers of U.S. troops. It's called Afghanistan.
Right next to everybody else.
I would argue that just like Garland said, we never really controlled Iraq. I think we controlled Iraq more than we ever controlled Afghanistan.
Which
frankly.
Is none.
Because
relatively
speaking,
it's true.
The moment we leave Afghanistan, Afghanistan will largely go back to its tribal ways. You'll have Karzai in charge of Kabul. You've had many invaders in charge of the capital city. But otherwise, it's a warlord society, and there'll be a section of it, no doubt, that will go back to the Taliban and possibly back to Al-Qaeda.
No, they will not. They will not go back to their tribal ways.
Really?
They never left their tribal ways. So they can't go back. We made this little enclave in Kabul, and we have the king of Kabul, which he doesn't really control all that much. And we said, you know, we control the rest. They don't. He buys off the tribal warlords when he can.
So my view in Afghanistan, and I really think I'm being consistent here, gentlemen.
Consistency is not necessarily a virtue.
Well, maybe not. Maybe not.
I'm sorry.
I'm ready to leave Afghanistan, absolutely. But if certain areas constitute themselves as terrorists or Al-Qaeda, again, I wouldn't reinvade. I'm never a big fan of invasion, but I wouldn't mind bombing the heck out of them if we see terrorist camps having Al-Qaeda people and
so on.
You know,
you have to realize at some point, nobody likes to face this, and it's kind of ugly, but the reason you have terrorism, you know, it's not just that they're nuts. They're not just nuts.
No, they're not nuts.
How do you fight an empire like United States?
That's true.
There is no way. We have, you know, a military that is so big, bigger than everybody else's military combined. We have more economic power than anybody else. And if you happen to disagree with what the United States does, and there is some legitimate reason to disagree, I'm not favoring terrorism, but the natural response, this is natural. You've got to have terrorism to fight that kind of thing. It's the only way you can fight it. As horrible as that sounds.
See, I don't think that's true.
There is a pressure that we are creating in the world.
Why can't you march in the streets and condemn the United States? Does it have to destroy the Twin Towers?
That doesn't work real well against B-52s for some reason.
No. But I would never advocate the U.S.
There's something else, too. And see, this is one of the things that we don't discuss. And that is one of the issues, I believe, with the Palestinians in Gaza. And in some of our neighborhoods here in the United States. The issue is poverty and lack of opportunity.
Yes.
A person, I was a police officer, and I used to always say, I never remember arresting anyone for robbing some guy at an ATM that had a bachelor's degree. So when people have opportunity, so the issue often with the terrorism and things like that are people are angry. Oftentimes they're trying to figure out who is it that created this terrible environment that I have to live in, and they want to strike back at someone.
I'm really glad you said that, Garland, because that brings me as a way to wrap up this whole show, because we only
have
5 minutes left.
You mean we've solved all the problems?
Well, I think we have, because I think Garland's point is dead on, and it's the one thing that ties Egypt and Tunisia and Libya and Syria and Afghanistan and Iraq. It ties them all together. This is an entire region of people without much opportunity. You've got a few princes and sheikhs that have all the power because there's massive oil wealth. They're not sharing with the people. We might call them the 1%. But the 99%, particularly in a country like Egypt that's very poor, you have a lot of people. I would argue, look at how it all began. The fruit vendor, Bouazizi, in Tunisia, right? He wasn't trying to overthrow the Tunisian government. Certainly he wasn't trying to overthrow the whole Middle East. He wanted to sell his fruit. And some government bureaucrat took his fruit stand away, and he lit himself on fire. Let's never forget how all this began. Garland, I couldn't agree with you more about the real source of the problem, the real source of the anger. It's poverty. It's lack of opportunity. The problem is neither the leaders in the region nor, in many cases, the rebels in the region are going to change that dynamic and actually give an opportunity to the people of the region. I hope it will happen in Libya. It may well happen in Tunisia. By the way, my best hope is for Tunisia.
But the other side of that coin is we don't want it to change. And let's not pretend we do.
Well, we should.
Because we get our oil from them. Yep. We've been getting our oil from them for centuries. We have every major oil company that we have, which are the biggest oil companies in the world, invested and involved in these countries. We do not want to rock that boat. And until America ever, or any other powerful empire, gets a little bit humbled and says, wait a minute, we've got to stop building every relationship we have on resources. We have to go beyond that to start to build relationships.
That's one reason
it's not going to change.
That's one reason why I want to help in Syria, though, because in Libya, we could say, oh, well, they had oil. Iraq, they had oil. There goes the U.S. again. One of the reasons why I liked our intervention in Kosovo, and I'd like one in Syria, is because it's not about oil. The only reason could be humanitarian, and that would be good to have us on the right side.
Militaristically, it's not humanitarian.
Right.
Libya it was.
And if we go back, what we're dealing with now still is colonialism. I mean, if we stop talking about the Middle East as though it's 3 years old, and we go back, say, let's go back 100 years. What we have is a lot of countries, Western and now including Eastern countries, going into the Middle East and hooking up basically pumps to siphon their resources out so we can all live very well. And Terry made a great point, and that is when we talk about things changing for the better in a lot of these Middle East countries, of the dynamics of their financial and economic structure changing so that the people there can live better, the masses of people can live better. When I say we, I mean our corporate and political leaders don't want it to change because we will be sharing things and we won't have all the goodies. You know, we won't have the entire cake. They'll have maybe a couple slices.
And one other thing I want to mention, which it could be positive. You know, we talk about the Cold War as an example and mutual assured destruction, and we have this silly game that we pretend somehow or other that Ronald Reagan ended the Cold War, how absurd that is.
Yep.
But anyway, that the Russians just gave up and changed. There was militarism that prevented the war, Cold War, from getting worse. There was also something called cultural exchange. And we did, and I don't even remember who started it, but God bless them, whoever it was, we started massive cultural exchange with our supposed arch enemy. And yep. that created as much to change as anything else. We've got to do the same with Iran and every other country.
I really want to echo that because I think the more we have a cultural exchange, I think that's a great idea, Terry, with the Middle East, with all the people of the region, with Americans going there, with them coming here, with getting to know each other and seeing each other, we're more likely to survive. And I want to end on one more optimistic note because there is, I think, a note of optimism. And that's the country of Tunisia where it all began. Tunisia has some of the most educated population. I actually think Tunisia, unlike all the other countries, is most likely to actually achieve a liberal democracy where the people have a voice, where minorities are respected. And so Bouazizi may at least have saved his own country, if not the whole Middle East. Anyway, we do have to wrap up. This is the Raucous Caucus.
Oh, darn.
An hour went very fast. I am Mark Levine with
Terry D. Kester.
And Garland Nixon.
And we are here every Tuesday night. Please join us next week. Come down to 1211
New Street. You need to give out his email addresses and stuff?
Oh, yeah. Let's do that. You can I know you can tweet us at Raucous Caucus DC. I got a fan page on Facebook. I know Garland does, too.
Yes, or you can email me, garlandin@gmail.com. Facebook me.
And I'm more reserved. Go to WPFW.org. You can always contact me.
And my website is marklevinetalk.com. I store every Raucous Caucus show on there.
Oh, my
Leave
heavens.
A comment. Let me
You're
know what
nuts.
You think.
We got to
agree or disagree.
We gotta
and that's it. We will – I got to thank Daniel. And we got to thank David back
Kelly.
In the studio.
And Tariq. Little Tariq. We must never forget Tariq.
And Nizam Ali for letting us be here at Ben's Next Door. See you next week.
Celebrating Jazz Appreciation Month, this is WPFW Washington.